This is a group of psychiatric students. They were in a class, and their professor began this class telling the students that we're going to talk about today, what we're going to talk about today are emotional extremes that people go through. And he gave an illustration. For example, he asked, what's the opposite of joy? Hands popped up in the lecture hall, and he called on a young man, and the young man's answer was sadness. That's a good answer. And then he asked another question. What's the opposite of depression? And again, hands popped all across the room, went up, and a young lady answered elation. Yeah, that's a pretty good answer too. Now this fella here, he must have celebrated college like Steve. A little bitty too many nights out there, a little late with me and Steve. And so we found him kind of nodding off in the class. And the professor couldn't help but see him nodding off. So he called on him, and somebody nudged him, and the kid kind of bobbed up. And he's from Texas. That's where this young boy's from. And he said, yep, in his Texas accent, y'all meet me, sir? Y'all meet me? And the professor answered him, yes. What's the opposite of woe? This fella, he's trying to wake up. As it is, he's sitting there, and he's pondering for a minute. And then with that southern drawl that only a Texan, I can't do it because I'm not from Texas. I can sound like somebody from Arkansas, but not Texas. But in his Texas drawl, he said, well, now, sir, I reckon the opposite of war would be giddy up. Now, we giggled, and I did too, but you know, there's some real truth. There is some real truth to that, as we'll see this morning, because as we have been looking at David, now let me go on before I go there. This fellow's from Topeka, Kansas, close to home, Dr. Carl Menninger. Many of you may recognize Menninger. He's world-renowned for his psychiatric work. And he was giving a lecture I'm not sure what this lecture was, and that doesn't matter. But it was a mental health lecture. And there were mental health professionals there at that time, and there were just everyday lay people like you and I there. At the end of his lecture, which he did and appreciated, he let people ask questions. And one of the questions that somebody asked is, what would you advise a person to do if that person felt a nervous breakdown coming on? Now, everybody in the audience, and I mean everybody, expected Dr. Menninger to say, go see a psychiatrist immediately. I mean, that's what they thought he would say. You know, after all, he's a world-renowned psychiatrist. Treats depression. But here's what he said. Lock up your house. Go across the railroad tracks. Find somebody in need and help that person. That he sees is a better way of overcoming emotional depression, of being down, rather than go talking to some shrink. Do this, he said. Do this. Go find somebody and help them. And that is exactly what we're able to see. Oh, let me finish it. To overcome discouragement. Don't focus on yourself. Get involved in the lives of other people. Good counsel. That was really, by the way, he's a believer. Claimed to be. Good counsel. Excellent counsel that he gave. And it's counsel that I find this person that we're looking at, as we're continuing to look at this comparison that started about 8 weeks ago between emotional human enthusiasm and biblical zeal. I've gotten as far as the fourth of the six or seven that I have, and that was looking at an example of David's genuine zeal for the Lord. I picked David as an example because he really does manifest zeal for the Lord. I mean, it's stated clearly by the Holy Spirit that David was exceedingly zealous for the Lord. So there's things I can learn, I think I can learn, and I know I have, by looking at the life of David that perhaps ought to be begin to be formulated in my life, because I ultimately can show you these were things that are part of the life of Christ. And so that I can be truly a biblically zealous person, not somebody just rides an emotional wave. When we talked about zeal, very in David's or anybody else's, simply it's intense, passionate, volitional, emotional desire, in David's case, and for us it could be to do something else for the Lord. David's case was an example we're looking at. I could look at others in David's life. I chose this one. Was to build a temple for the house of the Lord because of his love. Because of his love for the Lord. And so we got the human enthusiasm side done. I'm coming down that biblical side, biblical zeal, looking at David, and I could have looked at any of these others I have up here for examples, shows us that genuine biblical zeal will always, always honor the Lord. It will glorify Him. And Daniel, Stephen, these were other examples. But David says, in the house, and as David is speaking, in the house that is to be built, this house that I had this tremendous zeal, this burning passion within me to build, and I've had for some time, is for the Lord. You don't say anything about for my name to be remembered, not to be dedicated to me. It was done solely for the Lord. And it must be very magnificent of fame and glory throughout all the countries, he says in 1 Chronicles 22:5. Now, what we've done so far, David was zealous. He manifested his zeal in his passionate desire to build a house for the Lord. And the Psalm 69:9, the 135th Psalm, the first five verses, directly state that as a fact. The zeal of thine house has eaten me up. David's words in Psalm 69. Secondly, to honor, this is to honor, it's to magnify God. And that's the difference between human enthusiasm, human zeal. Ultimately, it's to lift up the person with the zeal, is to put the spotlight on him. It's to make him or her appear bigger to others. Not David. It was to magnify the name of God. That's why he wanted to do this. Secondly, we saw that David's desire to build a temple was commended by God. It was commended by God, and yet at the same time, it was denied by God. And that, kind of where I sat, when, boy, how difficult that must have been. Something that you want with all your heart, all your soul, and you've given, you'll see, a good part of your life, getting prepared to do this. But God says, go tell David. And I love the next two words, my servant. My servant. It indicated God's love for David. It indicated that what David wanted to do was not something that was wrong. David, my servant, thus saith the Lord, thou shalt not build me a house to dwell in. And so God said, no. He clearly said, no. Now, if this was human enthusiasm, something that you're doing because you're riding a wave of emotion, and you're carrying this wave going forward. Boy, I'm going to do this, and all of a sudden God says no. You know what I think happens to most people? Yeah, I think they flip out and they burn out. They get taken under the wave of the no. And the so-called zeal for God's gone. Because it really wasn't zeal for God at all. But in the case of David, and this is where we are, and this is why I went through this example, chose to use him, it doesn't diminish. He has this incredible zeal to do something. God says, no, you can't do it. But the zeal does not diminish. He continued to have this burning desire. There wasn't any decline in his desire. There wasn't any dwindling. The flame of zeal didn't, you know, flick out when God said, "Thou shall not build." It didn't matter. David remained zealous. We saw last week, he manifested that zeal by being intently involved in planning of the temple. And there's a principle from this. Some of these just keep rolling in, which I don't have in writing. But remember last week, it was here. Then I'll put the principle. Then David gave to Solomon, his son, the pattern of the porch of the temple and of its houses and of its treasuries and of its upper chambers and of its inner parlors and of the place of the mercy seat, 1 Chronicles 28:11, and the pattern of all that he had by the Spirit of the Lord. The principle that rolls from that, God said, no, you can't build a temple, but God gave him something else that he could do. He allowed him to participate. And so if God says no to something you want to do, I would say, first of all, stand still. Just listen for a bit. Instead of getting all discouraged and just walk away, sit still for a minute and listen. Perhaps the Lord has something else for you to do in relationship to that big thing that you wanted to do. He had that for David. And part of it was planning, as it says here. And the pattern that is the blueprint, is what I'd use today, of all that he had by the Spirit of the Lord, all of the chambers round about and the treasures of the house of God and the treasuries of dedicated things, the whole temple plan and everything that was to go into it. God gave that information to David. He let him record that and then to pass it on to Solomon. So he was very, very much involved in the planning. Now, here's something else he was allowed to do. He procured the place. We saw that last Sunday. The Spirit of God revealed to David, this is the place I wanted it to be. The 135th Psalms, pretty much, I'm paraphrasing it, but David said, I'm not going to eat or sleep until I can find a place in the temple of the Lord. Meaning that was the top priority in his life. God fulfilled that. We saw that last week, looking at 1 Chronicles 22:1 particularly, and then going back into 1 Chronicles 21:18 through 28, and 24:18 to 25. Okay. Then David said, the house of the Lord is to be here, and also the altar of burnt offerings for Israel. I've used the NIV, which I normally don't, because it has the closest translation to the Greek text, or the Hebrew text. Then David said, the house of the Lord is to be here, and the altar of the burnt offerings is to be here. That's literal, for Israel. And here referred to the threshing floor of Ornan. At that time when David saw that the Lord had answered him, that is, where am I to build the temple? In the threshing floor of Ornan, the Jebusite, then he sacrificed there. So David gave to Ornan for the place 600 shekels of gold by weight. He procured it. He bought it. God gave him that opportunity. Not building the temple, but I'm not closing the door to allowing you to have, to operate, to function, to do things for me. And this morning I'm going to turn your attention yet to another. I'm trying to keep these in peace, so hopefully they'll help. Planned. Procured the place, and he procured labor and materials to start the building of the temple. 1 Chronicles 22:2-4, and also 14:16, we'll spend a little time with both of those. We read in 1 Chronicles 22:2, and David commanded together the sojourners, or some of your texts may say aliens, who are in the land of Israel. And he set masons to you, wrought stone, that stone had already been cut out, to build a house of God. David does this. Now, just maybe a word or two about the word sojourners, or this word aliens. The ge'im. The ge'im means, the right term for it is resident aliens. What resident aliens were is something I guess this country has lost concept of. A resident alien was someone, or sometimes whole groups of people, that were allowed to live in a land legally. They didn't just move in, kind of tried to settle. They came in legally and were allowed to stay in the land. In the case of, and they would come for various reasons. Same reason they come today. Economic reasons. Your land went through a famine. You didn't have food. You didn't have work. The Israelites did what during the time of Jacob? They moved down to where? Egypt. They became Gerim, resident aliens. They took up residence for economic reasons, to survive. And you could come for political reasons. Maybe your country's overthrown by a government that's hostile to you, that you can't relate to. There were various reasons for coming. Now, in Israel, the Old Testament, and you can look at some of this, I'm not going to, it's different. Because the Israelites, and it goes, the Lord uses this over and over, the way you treat the Gerim in your country, you're going to treat them like yourself. Okay? You treat them like yourselves. Yeah, they can be slaves and other things, but you're going to treat them fairly. For you were sojourners in Egypt. And so you'll see that throughout, if you bother to look at some of the passages and stuff, things I have up here. But one of the things you kind of traded out as a Gerim to be able to come in and to settle into a land, if that's how you were there and stayed, is that the practice of the day, when it came to doing public services, the building of public places, Gerim labor was usually conscripted to do that. And you knew that was a part of the deal. And that's what you have here when he talks about these sojourners, or, and again, I would use the two words resident aliens, because that's what they communicate. And we'll see that King Solomon conscripted forced labor out of all Israel, and the levy was 30,000 men. Well, why did Solomon do that? He did it because if you go back here, and Solomon was young. He needed some guidance. He did it because he saw his father David do it. The Gerim. Yeah, and it conscripted or forced is correct. It was non-optional for the Gerim. And when he says of all Israel, there was not one Israelite that was forced into forced labor to work on the temple. None. The Gerim came from, the labor force came from the Gerim. So when David commanded together the sojourners who were in the land of Israel, he sent masons to hew wrought stone to build the house of God. Now, what Solomon did, it was so that Solomon numbered all the resident aliens, sojourners, who were in the land of Israel. Where did he get the numbers? Remember last week, the census David took that he shouldn't have? He had the number. And so he knew that there were, he knew how many, and he took 153,600 were found. That's how many were living in Israel. Most of the people Solomon took were people, now here, let's look, God got the text, they were just left. Here's what he did with them. He appointed 70,000 of the Gerim to carry loads, 80,000 to quarry stones in the mountains, and 3,600 supervisors to make the people do the work. Most of which came from, and all of the people who were left of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, who were not of the children of Israel. When Israel came into the land, they were not able to completely obliterate and conquer all the people. These were people they did not completely conquer. And those people continued to have children, and they continued to live in the land of Israel. When it came time for the conscripted labor, this is where Solomon drew most of his force from these people, and he put them to work. Their children who were left after them in the land whom the children of Israel were not able to utterly destroy. Of those did Solomon conscript for forced labor, and so unto this day. There are those who say he got him out of Israel, but this tells you, no, he didn't. Tells me where he got up, and he says, even so unto this day, and you could not find conscripted people coming out of Israel at any point in time by Israelites or those in of order. Okay, that's so he gets his conscripted labor force. First thing David does, let me get the initial workforce together. You're going to, this be a massive project. Solomon's early 20s. He's not yet lived much life. Okay. Now, how are you going to go about building this? His father sets for him, here's the pattern. Gives him the blueprints, now here's what you do. So I brought in men. You're going to have to go get more, probably. But I'll get you started. And David prepared materials. He prepared iron in abundance for the nails of the doors, for the doors of the gates, and for the joinings in bronze in abundance beyond weight. Probably hyperbole. You probably could have weighed the iron if you wanted to, but it was so much, why bother? It was going to be more than sufficient iron. Now, this, you misprized. We don't, you know, I think of iron in terms of scrap iron. It's not worth much today. It really isn't. But it was then. I mean, it was worth a lot. Both iron and nails, they were valuable. And they were expensive. We just don't think in terms of them being so. But Joshua 6:19, Ezekiel 22:8, Joshua 22:8, Ezekiel 37:12. Just show you an example of iron. You can do it one way. Of having a tremendous amount of value at that time. The Lord is speaking. He's telling the people what you're going to take after you demolish Jericho. But all the silver and gold and vessels of bronze and iron. Iron. Notice iron is listed with bronze, gold, and silver. Are consecrated unto the Lord. What did you do with the iron? You put it in the treasury of the Lord. Well, what do you put in your treasury? I don't put stuff that doesn't have value. You put things that are valuable. Iron had tremendous value. Joshua 6:19. Here's another example from Ezekiel. Tarshish, Spain. Okay? When you read about Tarshish in the Bible, think of Spain. That's what they're talking about. This part of southern Spain refers to Tarshish. And you can see, I wouldn't call it ease, but you can see how one could take ships, and you could even be very careful and do this, and they do try to stay as close as possible to coastlines, and you can travel, staying close to the coastlines, all the way over here from Israel to Tarshish. And they did. And there was a great deal of commerce that went on, and that's this passage. Tarshish was your customer because of abundance. Notice these next words: of all kinds of wealth. And what's included in all kinds of wealth? With silver, iron, and tin. I don't say my tin cans either. In value. But the Iron Age had only been maybe a couple hundred years. I mean, iron was really, you know, it was coming into its own. And they used in lead. They paid for your wages. When I say iron was coming into its own, it was used for all kinds of things that were practical and needful. If you had money, you had iron cooking utensils. You were happy to have iron pots to cook in. Iron pots for carrying water, to skillets to build in, jugs to drink from. You were in the upper class. Most people had pottery. Couldn't afford it. But the rich could. This was stuff of the rich. And here's things that the poor did try and scrape together. Iron was very commonly used for tools. Tools that you had to have to make a living. Now, this was an agricultural society, and you can see a sickle up here. You see an axe up here with on one side you have an axe, the other side you have a sledgehammer. These were all valuable working tools. And these are passages. If you want to look them up, you can see iron was used. We're talking about David giving something that had a tremendous amount of value. That's all I'm trying to point out with this. Here, you want to go to war? One of the most vital war instruments of the day was iron. It's one of the reasons the Israelites never could knock out the Philistines completely. Remember, Israel came from where? Egypt. What do they have for weapons? None. What did they know about being able to forge iron? Nothing. And if Philistines caught one of their people teaching the Israelite how to forge iron and to build on anything, they'd kill them. Because in here you see swords and daggers and arrowheads. Again, these are weapons of war. But the greatest weapon of war, probably of all, was the iron chariot. That was the tank of the day. Israel didn't have any. Their enemies did. It took iron to get these things. So I just pointing out that iron has value. It's used aesthetically. Vases, you can see over here a couple of sculptures done with iron. And I ran across these later. There's some iron chains, another iron tool, even keys. It was very, very valuable. That's all I want you to underscore. David prepared iron, that which was exceedingly valuable in abundance. Why? For the nails of the doors. Big deal. The nails. Who cares? So I think nails. Here's what I think, because I looked to see. This is from Home Depot. $4.97 for a box of 100, 2-inch nails. Yeah, dirt cheap. Good grief. Didn't cost anything. Not quite so with iron nails. Do you know how an iron nail was made? This is what they look like. These are examples of iron nails found by archaeologists that date to that time period. You can see, boy, you need a strong arm to drive those suckers. But that's what they were. And what made them so expensive is the way they had to be made. It took the iron ore. It took a fire to forge the iron. It took an anvil, and it took a hammer. And you made nails, one nail at a time. I looked to see if anybody could tell me how many nails a blacksmith could make in a day. I couldn't find out. So I don't know, but I know it wasn't a bunch. I know they were so valuable that when buildings burnt down, people would go to the burnt buildings instead of trying to get, today they try and get copper out of buildings. They went and got all the nails. They would collect up all the nails that survived these fires and use them again because they were so valuable. So here you go, one nail at a time. I think you can understand why they had value to people who wanted to build. Just want you to know that when David prepared iron in abundance for the nails of the doors of the gates, that was something that was very expensive. Now this other thing, the joinings, or some of your texts say clamps. I forgot what they said. I had no clue what he was talking about, and I still don't really quite understand. I see what they look like. Here they are. I don't know why they used them. Neither could anybody else really give me a reason for it. What was done in big building projects like you're seeing here, these are two separate blocks. They would cut out, a notch out, holes on either side of the block, and these clamps then were driven into these two separate blocks to hold the blocks together. The best I can guess, it was maybe to keep the blocks from settling, or if they settled, they would settle together. No one can explain why. But you can see that there's one in here, and here's one that's just, they're open, nothing has yet been put in it, because they could go vertically, they could go horizontally. You could turn these things either way. But this was a necessary element, and obviously they knew more about building than we did. Now, but we cannot make a building last 20 years. It's mind-boggling to me that we think we need to replace a stadium that we built 20 years ago. Maybe we should go back and get some iron clamps and start building them this way. Because these buildings lasted for centuries. Literally, centuries. I don't get it. And it may have been, maybe they were using foundations only. This would give you an idea. All of these blocks were laid out. There they were, and they had these iron nails in them. So one or two things either happen with these, and I think joinings make better sense because they're joining two things together. Either A, they built the clamp and drove the clamp into them. Some believe that they actually had portable smelters, and maybe they were sophisticated. Iron get about 2,800 degrees before it melt. And some believe that is how they did it. They had portable smelters, and they made the iron and poured it into the notches. I don't know which was the case, but I know it took iron to make them, and I know you could see, think about the size of that temple. All of the walls and the blocks of the temple. how many of these things they could have used. Just enormous amounts. So David prepared iron in abundance, and he also prepared bronze. It's the other thing he prepared in abundance, bronze. That happens to be a mirror. So that give you an idea when Paul says we look now in a mirror darkly, even highly polished, you can, and that one is, that piece isn't anymore. But highly polished, you're going to get a strange reflection, not a perfect image like we do in our mirrors. And David prepared iron in abundance for the nails of the doors of the gates and for the joinings, and bronze in abundance, beyond weight. Just massive amounts, just like iron. Bronze was exceedingly valuable. And they burned the city, Jericho, with fire, and all that was in it, only the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze in abundance, and iron put they into the treasury of the house of the Lord. So you see bronze right along with gold, silver, you see it going in the treasury. So that tells me this is valuable materials. And David had those materials in abundance. And you think about the bronze that's used in the temple. Just a few things that I could get images of quickly. The two pillars, they were bronze. All of the instruments that were used in the temple, not all of them, some of them made of pure gold, but many of the instruments, the serving instruments, the lavers, the things that the priest used, they were all made of bronze. The little carts that you read about, they're made of bronze. The bronze altar, the bronze sea, all of this bronze was used in the temple. It had come from somewhere. And David gave it to them in abundance. A very expensive commodity. Also cedar trees in abundance. For the Sidonians and they of Tyre brought much cedar wood to David too. Now, when he talks of, they didn't give it to him. At least I don't think they did. A map again. These are the Sidonians and those of Tyre. You hear that this is modern-day Lebanon in this area. And here is Tyre. Here is Sidon. In this area, Lebanon at that time, it was renowned for the cedar that it grew. Now, I don't know who I got this quote from, or I would have. These aren't my words, and I'm sorry I lost track of who I scribbled information down from. But he tells you this: the cedar of Lebanon was held in high esteem, not only for its vigor, beauty, and age, but also for the fragrance and remarkable lasting qualities of the wood. And it was also employed to symbolize might, majesty, dignity, lofty stature, and wide expansion. Now, that's a couple of weeks ago. I went through quite a bit of this stuff with you on the use of cedar. Again, common folk didn't use cedar, but kings did. People with money. You find cedar used for palaces. You find cedar used for temples of other gods. And this material was very expensive, and it was considered to symbolize might, majesty. David's going to use it in the temple, you bet. Because the temple represents the presence of God here upon earth. And it has to be made of the best of the very best. There was no... David was a man of grace and didn't skimp on money. Didn't bother him a bit. He took what he used because the house that is to be built for the Lord must be very, he says, must be very magnificent. Very magnificent. The Hebrew literally reads that it has to be to make great above beyond. He wants it above great. He wants it being beyond great. Very magnificent. Probably a pretty good translation of the Hebrew to get that across. This thing was to be spectacular. It was to be, you walk up to it and you just, your jaw just dropped. It was eye-popping in its beauty, in its majesty, because it represented the God who David loved with all of his heart and all of his soul. I think you, here, of fame in glory throughout all the countries. I will therefore now make preparation for it. This is what the house was to do. It was to cause God's name to expand throughout the whole region. Yahweh, He is the one great God above all other gods. It is Yahweh who is the all-powerful God. It is Yahweh who is the magnificent one, and David wanted the whole world to know it. And so he put everything he could into that temple that would result in that being the end. To give you an idea, Haggai speaks, and I think this helps you give an idea of how grand that temple must have been. Remember that it got destroyed by the Babylonians, and Nehemiah and a group came back, and they began the rebuilding of the wall and the rebuilding of the temple. And we're talking about this temple of Zerubbabel. And here's what Haggai has to say. Who is left among you that saw this house, referring to the temple that now stood, Zerubbabel's temple, in its first glory? How do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison with it as nothing? The present temple is just nothing. It was nothing. Nothing compared to the temple David got involved with building. Now, here's a point or two. I'm not going to finish what I wanted today at all. David was zealous. I want you to see this. He was zealous in doing behind-the-scene details for the building of the temple, which others wouldn't see. How many people would realize, hey, we've got all these nails? Yeah, David. Nobody. There's nails. And besides, I'm being forced to drive these nails in the wall. I don't care who made them. In fact, I wish nobody would have. God wasn't happy to see all these nails. Behind the scenes, no one saw these things that David was doing. Probably the only person who knew much of it was Solomon and a handful of others. Here. And David prepared iron in abundance for the nails of the doors of the gates and for the joining, and bronze in abundance beyond weight. He did that. Nobody's aware. The house that is to be built for the Lord must be very magnificent of fame and of glory throughout all countries. I will therefore now make preparation for it. So David prepared abundantly. This is all stuff that you don't see. I worked construction for a couple of summers. It was great. I just did what was laid in front of me. I didn't know who did the drawing, who prepared the diggings, the footings. I don't know who went and procured the forms that we carried. I could care less. All I cared about was Friday, give me my beer money, and I'm gone. Okay, that's it. Had no idea who was behind it. David was not out in the forefront. Spotlight wasn't shining on him. Doing all of this privately. And I'm going to give you an application. We, as believers today, we ought to be zealous. We ought to be zealous to do behind the scenes work. We ought to have just as much zeal to undertake a small thing for the Lord as to some big grand something. You don't have to stand before 35,000 people in the stadium to be doing something that honors or glorifies the Lord. You don't have to write a check for $500,000 to get a building started to do something that will glorify the Lord. We ought, if we are truly zealous for the Lord, it should not matter what door He opens, what opportunity He gives, how insignificant that might seem to you and I, it should not matter at all. And I've got all of these passages. I'm not going to look at any of them with you. But I'm just going to point out a couple of things about them. How glorious do you think it is to wash somebody's feet? In the scheme of life, how big a deal can that be that you've washed somebody's feet? Well, it's a great big deal. Memorialized for all eternity. A woman came in, used her hair, and she washed the feet of the Lord. And we know about that today. And what about the poor woman the disciples jumped all over? Mary. Because she used some alabaster oil to do what? Again, in the scheme of things, how important is it to wash somebody's hair? no big deal. 100 years from now, who's going to know? Now, she didn't wash the hair. She used the oil that was in there, and that ointment for the Lord. Not a big deal. What makes these things a big deal? Let me say this to you, and I hope, if you don't remember nothing else I've ever said my entire time that you're here, that you'll remember this. It's not the deed, okay? It's not the deed that makes the act significant. It's who you're doing it for. That's what makes it significant. That's what makes it important. It's just as significant. I probably shouldn't use this illustration, but I'm going to. I couldn't use it because it's not fair. It's not true from my perspective. But look, if we were involved today in the building of the temple, and somebody said, "Lou, go to Home Depot, pick up a box of nails." How important would it be to go to Home Depot? Well, to me, that would be a big deal to me. You see, I don't go to Home Depot. I refuse to go to Home Depot. I do a lot of things in my shop. I clean the toilets. I clean the floors. I do all that stuff. But I pull rank when it comes to going to Home Depot or Costco. I don't go. You have to go. You get to go. I don't go there. So I probably shouldn't use this. How do they stay in business? How can a company B have such poor service? I wish I could have a business like that. No, I don't either. I like servicing people. But look, how important can it be to go get a box of nails, huh? No big deal. Yeah, it is. It is if you're getting the box of nails to do something for Jesus. That's what makes it a big deal. That. It's who you're doing it for. It's not what you're doing. So I hope that you will remember something. And the thing that you will remember, look, I think it's just as significant, perhaps more significant, that Carol and Dwayne will go visit Mary. Okay? It's me standing here to teach. Why do that? Well, for the least that you've done to one of these of mine, you're doing that for Jesus. I keep trying to get that across to her, by the way. She just gets so apologetic. And it's hard to receive grace, I understand. Again, but there's always two hands in the matter of giving. There's the hand that gives, the hand that receives. I've been on both ends. If I have my choice, I'd rather be the hand that gives. But let me say this to you. If you're on the hand that receives, please be able to receive graciously. Because God has given an opportunity for one person to be able to honor Him in this way. It's being done for Jesus. You tell me what thing is more important for Jesus than another. These tables don't just pop from the sky. Wish they did. They don't automatically get set up. It's just as important as the tables are set up that I'm standing here. Because if you don't have tables set up, places to sit, we're not going to have class. We're not going to be able to fellowship. We do the things we do for the Lord. All of them. And one thing is not more important than another. And I think it's so easy to illustrate. He says there are many parts of the body. You tell me which is the most significant. The little toe is just as important as the head. And I don't know if this is true, and I'm not about to try it. I'm going to ask my podiatrist next time I see him. If you cut both of my little toes off, I've been told I can't keep balance. I can't stand. Well, that makes them pretty important to me, because I kind of like standing up. Might seem insignificant to you, not the least bit insignificant to the Lord. So I would hope we could take away from this, and I know I'm not getting anywhere near what's on your note sheet, so we'll just have to pick up next week. I hope we'll take away from this as we walk out of here that whatever opportunity the Lord has for us, whatever thing He opens for us to do, we ought to be zealous to undertake and do it. Do it. Because you're doing it for Him. Let's close.